Good evening. Man, you guys are so prompt and easy to wrangle. It is a pleasure being here. Welcome to the John Jay Homestead and the beginning of our 2020 Scholars Lectures. I'm Melissa Vale, a trustee of the Friends and chair of the Scholars Committee. First, some logistics. There are the fire exits, and please turn off your phones. Next, some thank yous to our Scholars Committee, who are listed on the back of your program, for giving us their financial, intellectual, and moral support. If you're on the Scholars Committee, would you raise your hands? Oh, look, you're wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks to our public partner, the New York State Department of Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation, and to our state and friends, staffs, and volunteers, including our hardworking trustees. Maybe when you drove in, you noticed some new roofs on some of our outbuildings. And we are really excited to announce that we've just won a grant, matching grant, but still, for a big fire suppression project in this House of Treasures. Those are thanks, yes, to our public partner and our hardworking staffs. And most important, thanks to our members. If you're not yet a member, look around and on the website and see what membership would bring you in addition to Pride. We're grateful to all of you for your support. For our upcoming events, for events in general, see our calendar and website, especially our special themed house tours. We have a whole series of different focus house tours coming up this winter. And the next two evenings in our 2020 Scholar Series, February 11th, we have Steve Luxenberg on the landmark Supreme Court case Plessy versus Ferguson, which said separate but equal is just fine. And on March 12th, we have Eric Foner on the Reconstruction Amendments to the Constitution, 13, 14, and 15. Now tonight, our theme this year is dissent in our democracy, and we'll see examples of hot and cool dissent, reactive and long game, successful and not so successful, and some which are the whole mess altogether. And those of you who have come before to our talks know that we always highlight not only some contemporary resonance of a talk, but also a Jay connection. And tonight we have one straight out of Joanne Freeman's book. The most famous case of violence in Congress is the 1856 caning of Massachusetts Senator Charles Sumner by South Carolina Congressman Preston Brooks, 2 days after Sumner had delivered a speech entitled The Crime Against Kansas, which Brooks heard as an attack on his cousin, Senator Andrew Butler of South Carolina. Here, in this case, is our copy of the first printing of the speech, and the publisher is the same one who published the writings of William Jay. I'm going to give you a short quote. The senator from South Carolina has read many books of chivalry and believes himself a chivalrous knight with sentiments of honor and courage. Of course, he has chosen a mistress to whom he has made his vows, and who, though ugly to others, is always lovely to him, though polluted in the sight of the world, is chaste in his sight. I mean the harlot slavery. For her, his tongue is always profuse in words. Well, those were fighting words, and I'll let Joanne give you more context and detail of this most dramatic but not singular incident. Joanne Freeman is the recently appointed Class of 1954 Professor of American History at Yale, where she specializes in the founding period, political culture in the 18th and 19th centuries, how elite politicians fought political battles and each other. She's as much a public intellectual as academic, writing and speaking and consulting widely. She's also a leading authority on Alexander Hamilton and will be the faculty enticement on a week-long Yale educational travel cruise about Caribbean culture starting January 24th, which sounds pretty nice with this sudden cold weather. Are there still spots? I don't know. Check it out. Please join me in welcoming Joanne Freeman.
Thank you for that introduction. I always tell my students, pick a founder from the Caribbean, and you're set. So I think the name of the trip is Hamilton and His World. And luckily, his world included St. Eustatius and some islands in the Caribbean. So before I begin, I was just mentioning to Melissa, something occurred to me sitting down here, and I can't believe in all of our emailing back and forth, it never occurred to me, but I grew up in Yorktown Heights. I literally sitting here went on the phone, and I was like, really? Like, this is the Katona I remember from when I was a kid, and look how close it is to Yorktown Heights. So I am yours. Okay. Now, I am really pleased to be here this evening to talk to you about the topic of my recently published book, which, as Melissa said, is about physical violence. And it's actually physical violence in the U.S. Congress. It tells the previously untold story of physical violence in the House and Senate chambers in the decades leading up to the Civil War. Now, I'm going to admit right at the outset that 17 years ago when I started writing this book, it did not feel timely. I was writing a book about violent and high partisanship and all of these things from the 19th century, and things have changed enough around the book that it came out at a moment that feels very different from when I was writing it. But what has remained constant throughout those 17 years is indeed, as Melissa suggested, the fact that throughout that time when I would say to people, well, I'm writing on physical violence in the U.S. Congress, if they knew nothing else, they knew about Sumner, they didn't know the name, and they would usually say, there was that guy. Yes, there was that guy. Who is Sumner? They would know vaguely that that happened. The book's title is actually taken from a response to Sumner's caning. So not long after the attack by Preston Brooks, a friend of Sumner's wrote to him, that blood would flow, somebody's blood, before the expiration of your present session on that field of blood, the floor of Congress, I have fully expected. For that person writing that letter, physical violence in Congress wasn't only not a surprise, he expected it. He was waiting to see who was going to be the victim, and he literally called the floor of Congress the field of blood. Obviously, as a historian, that's like a Nirvana quote. I have a book title now. Thank you very much. Now, we don't tend to envision the antebellum Congress in this way, right? We think of Henry Clay and Daniel Webster and, you know, great oratory happening in the Senate, particularly somber debate. But there was a lot of violence on the House and Senate floors between 1830 and 1860. I ended up finding roughly 70 physically violent incidents in the pre-Civil War Congress. And I would guess throughout that time that maybe about 10% of a given House of Representatives was likely to be someone who would be violent. And by physically violent, I mean canings, shoving, fist fights, people pulling knives and guns on each other, dual negotiations, wild melees, usually in the House, with bunches of men rolling in the aisles, throwing punches, jumping on chairs, and a handful of street fights with fists, bricks, and the occasional umbrella. Now, obviously, this is a dramatic story, and it raises a really obvious question. Why has no one told the story before? And believe me, when I was working on the book, I asked it again and again and again. How is it possible that we don't know about the violence, and I'm going to talk today as well about what it means and what it did? Well, there is an answer to that question, and the answer is most of the violence was essentially censored out of the period's equivalent of the congressional record. There are clues in the record, and I should say that the record at the time, there wasn't in the time period I'm writing about the sort of formal record we have now, newspaper reporters acted basically as also people recording debate. I'll come back to that in a moment. But the record, after I discovered the violence, I then went to look at the record to see what does it show in that moment when so-and-so punched so-and-so. So, for example, it'll say something like, quote, "The debate became unpleasantly personal at some point." In that particular instance, one congressman actually pulled a gun on another congressman, which you would not know from that statement. Or the record will say something like, "There was a sudden sensation in the corner," and it'll say nothing else. On that particular occasion, two congressmen got in a fight and they flipped over their desk. Enormous brawls get mentioned, but in the very barest detail, as in the case of one huge fight in 1849 that was summed up by a poetic writer in some way or another. This one involved people jumping on chairs and standing on tables. This was a real gusto fight. The record only says in brackets, "The house is like a heaving billow." That's it. Now, this leads to another obvious question. Why? Right? Why such limited accounts of violence? And part of it has to do with the nature of the Washington press in this period. And as I mentioned just a few moments ago, in the 1830s, the Washington press consisted of a handful of men working for a handful of local Washington newspapers who sat in the House and Senate, scribbled notes, checked them with the congressman who'd been speaking, and published their accounts not only in newspapers, but also in spin-off publications that essentially acted as a congressional record. The newspapers that these reporters were working for were unquestionably, unapologetically partisan. So objective news is not, I always say on the radar screen, and I know that doesn't work for 1830, but objective news was not yet a goal at this point. So as a reporter, it was in your interest to make your party's congressman look good. It was also in your interest as a reporter to make congressmen look good because Congress granted government printing contracts. And government printing contracts is how most newspapers stayed in business. Plus, unhappy congressmen occasionally slugged the reporter who made them unhappy. So for all of those reasons, the Washington press had a lot of reason to smooth over the rough edges of what was going on in Congress. So that although they played up the bravado of many congressmen, right, they can't stray too far from reality or no one's going to believe anything they say. They're trying to leave something of an accurate record. It just leans in one direction or another. They played up sometimes the bravado, particularly of congressmen from their party, and left most of the nasty details out. So that's part of the answer to the question as to why the story hasn't been told. If you're not looking for it, you're not going to find it. It's not obvious. So all kinds of people obviously use the congressional record in their research, but if you didn't know the violence was there, you probably wouldn't notice it. Which brings me to another question. Given that, how did I find it? And this answer is going to make a lot of sense. When I started this project, I wasn't thinking I shall now write about violence because I didn't know it existed. I said, well, I'm interested in the culture of politics, and I'm interested in violence and why politics becomes violent. And I just finished a book on the 1790s, so let's go a little ahead in time and see what the culture of politics is. And all I knew going in was, well, in 1838, one congressman killed another in a duel. So my thought was, okay, I'm going to find the letters of a congressman who was a friend of the fellow who was killed and see what he says, and he'll give me some insight into what people are thinking or feeling about that kind of an event. And as luck would have it, he wrote almost every day to his wife. And those letters contained all the details. Letters to wives was how I found the violence. That's the only place congressmen would say, you know, that they were nervous at the tone of debate. They were afraid of what was going to happen. There's one letter to a wife in which this wonderful congressman from North Carolina named, I'm going to forget his last name now, David, I'll come back to him. He does have a wonderful name. I've led up to it. Now I can't remember what it is. He admitted in this letter to his wife, counting how many people in the room he thought were armed. That kind of a detail you don't get anywhere else. He and a fellow of his, David Outlaw. It's a good name. So yes, David Outlaw writes a letter saying, you know, I counted 70 and he counted 80 or something. And there are a lot of people in the House that were armed. One letter to a wife even jokingly said, maybe we should only elect really large men to Congress. Now, obviously, that kind of evidence is really anecdotal. It's one letter at a time, one congressman writing to his wife at a time. But it said something suggestive about the dynamics of power on the floor of Congress. And that idea ended up being key to me in trying to figure out Congress and politics in this period. So what did I do with that kind of insight into the dynamic, what it felt like to be on the floor? Well, not surprisingly, when I looked at intimidation and violence and threats and everything else that I found, looking over the 30-year period at the heart of my book, I saw patterns. So for one thing, and this probably isn't surprising, the House was more physically violent than the Senate. The Senate was a smaller body, a more personal institution. The members were usually of a little bit higher social status than the House. They tended towards dual challenges in the Senate. The House was rougher, tending towards scuffles, pushing, shoving, and weapons, pistols and bowie knives. I once went on a tour of at the Smithsonian, one of their weapon rooms, because I felt that I needed to see what the bowie knives and pistols that these fellows were carrying around looked like. They would strap the bowie knives to their back, and they would put the pistols in their boot sometimes. It's a culture I did not know anything about. And I do want to note, as I plunge into violence here, it is worth noting, this kind of behavior is not happening only in Congress. The United States itself was violent in this period, exceedingly so, and Congress was a representative institution in many senses of the word. What was distinctive in Congress was the sectional complications and the national implications of that kind of behavior, and I'm going to come back to that idea in a moment. So there was an institutional pattern of violence differentiating the House from the Senate. But in addition to that institutional pattern, there's another more striking pattern of violent outbreaks that's worth noting, and that's a geographic pattern. Generally speaking, congressmen divided their ranks into two kinds of men, and I'm going to offer you the actual lingo from the time, so this isn't me coming up with a juicy way of describing this. They would break their ranks into fighting men and non-combatants. They would sometimes ask, are you a non-combatant or are you a fighting man, to sort of help them decide how they should treat that other person. Now, most so-called fighting men were Southerners or Southern-born Westerners. They were more likely to be armed and more likely to be willing to fight man-to-man. Southern culture, a slavery-based culture, was grounded on man-to-man violence in many ways. Northerners, for the most part, on the other hand, were non-combatants. Now, this isn't to say that the North wasn't violent. It was. But, and this is going to be a very broad generalization, Northerners tended towards rioting, and Southerners tended towards man-to-man violence. So it was violent in many places, but man-to-man violence proved to be a really useful skill in Congress, which means that, generally speaking, Southerners bullied Northerners in Congress, often to protect the institution of slavery. They insulted and threatened and sometimes assaulted Northerners to intimidate them into compliance or silence. And for a time, this worked quite well. For a time, Southerners really wielded an outsized influence on the floor of Congress and protected their slave regime in the process. In the same way that Southerners had outsized demographic power in Congress because of the Three-Fifths Compromise that gave Southern states added representation, they had outsized cultural power because of the power of their bullying. So that pattern all by itself is striking, but equally striking is the fact that Southerners back home approved of their champions on the floor. They might not know the dirty, nasty details of what their representatives were doing, but they knew their representatives were fighting for the institution of slavery, and they liked it. So not surprisingly, Southern fighting men tended to get reelected. This is an age when many, many people, it was a churning body of congressmen, many, many people served only one term, possibly two. So getting reelected meant something. And a great example of a Southern fighting man who had a fighting record is a Virginia congressman named Henry Wise, who ended up being my book's most frequent fighter. He wasn't some kind of a back alley brawler. He was an educated man. He went on to become the governor of Virginia. And he was also constantly rolling up his sleeves to throw a punch. When reprimanded by a fellow congressman for his behavior, and essentially this man said, you should be sent home for this. You should be expelled. Look at what you're doing. Look at what you're doing to the House. Shame on you. He responded, go ahead, expel me. I'll be immediately reelected and brought right back here. This is what my constituents want me to do. It's why I'm here, to fight for their rights. And the proof of that is that Wise was reelected 6 times, right? His constituents liked that behavior. He was standing up for their interests, and slavery was one of them. They approved of his bullying. And that kind of bullying, you can imagine, had an impact. Sometimes noncombatants would resign from committees when they were bullied. Sometimes they just chose not to speak out or object when a Southerner was speaking. If they did, they risked what happened to one Democratic congressman in the early 1840s. When he insisted on allowing Representative John Quincy Adams to have his say on a slavery petition, a Louisiana congressman stopped over to that congressman and threatened to, quote, cut his throat from ear to ear, revealing his Bowie knife to drive that message home. Okay, so with these basic patterns in play, you can see why and how there was a good deal of violence in Congress in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, leading up to the Civil War. You can also see why many onlookers felt justified in claiming that there was, quote, a slave power at the head of the national government, that the slave power controlled the government. The rhetoric in Congress had some truth to it. But in the 1850s, that began to change. And in part, this was due to the nation's continued push west and the rising problem of slavery on western lands. Logically enough, every state added to the Union put the question of slavery front and center. Would this be a free state? Would this be a slave state? So the nation's increasingly intense debate over slavery kept building and building and polarizing national politics to an ever-increasing degree. At the same time as the nation's growth was keeping the problem of slavery front and center, a new form of technology, the telegraph, made matters worse by transmitting news around the nation with breakneck speed before politicians could spin the news as they saw fit. So as the slavery problem intensified, the telegraph spread that intensity around the nation with increasing speed and without much congressional spin. Just as this sectional conflict is really festering, a new technology spread it faster and further than ever before. It would be hard to exaggerate the degree to which the telegraph changed the nature of politics. And actually, if you just think about social media, the moment that we're having now bears so many similarities to the moment with the telegraph, where suddenly, you know, there's a story of a congressman, actually there's a story of one senator pulling a gun on another senator, and there's a rumble and chair jumping and what normally happens, and the gun is pulled away and nothing happens, and they actually sit down to go back to work. And one, I think a New Hampshire congressman, stands up and says, you know, in 45 minutes, the whole country's going to know that that happened. They're going to think we're wallowing in blood in here in the Senate, so we better, like, tell them we're starting a committee or that we're doing something to take control. There was just, they were dealing with a whole new phenomenon, the fact that what they were doing was being spread, and they had absolutely no control over what was being spread. It spread remarkably fast. So basically, in the 1850s, a communications revolution, using the telegraph, connected national politicians and the American public as never before, bringing countless complications in its wake. If you think about it, democracy is an ongoing conversation between office holders and constituents. So it should come as no surprise that dramatic changes in the modes of conversation cause dramatic changes in democracies themselves. During the sectional crisis of the 1850s, the repercussions of this increasingly nationalized press were severe. By framing those crises for maximum impact, the press created an endless loop of sectional strife. Congressmen issued rallying cries to their constituents from the floor. The press played up the implications, and the public responded by urging their congressmen to fight for their rights. These extreme emotions were broadcast throughout the Union with ever-increasing speed and efficiency. The product of that cycle of stridency was pronounced. By portraying Congress as an institution of extremes, extreme rhetoric, extreme belligerence, a place of sectional conflict waged by sectional champions, the press downplayed the appeal and even the possibility of compromise. So in more ways than one, the floor of Congress became a theater of conflict. And the deaths around this time, I think in 1852, of Daniel Webster and Henry Clay seemed to confirm the passing of some kind of spirit of compromise in Congress. So with Americans already bound up in a struggle and losing faith in the power and meaning of national parties to deal with that struggle, national institutions of all kinds were under fire at precisely the moment when their influence most mattered. So ironically, the workings of a free press enforcing congressional accountability, which is at the very heart of our system, were helping to tear the nation apart. And the end result of these things, the rising intensity of the problem of slavery and the rise of the telegraph, was more violence in Congress, particularly given that the American public increasingly was cheering on their congressmen to fight. And by the 1850s, this was true for Northerners as well as Southerners. As Northerners got a sense of the degree to which their representatives were being silenced by bullying Southerners, they began to vote fighting men into Congress. The anti-slavery Republican Party came to power in the mid-1850s based on their promise to, quote, fight the slave power. That was their rhetoric. That's what they campaigned on. Posters, broadsides. We will fight the slave power. And you can see the appeal of that message when applied to Congress. And in Congress, working alongside Southerners, these Northern fighting men stayed true to their promise, fighting Southerners with resistance, fists, and occasionally with weapons. As these fighting Northerners said time and again, they refused to be intimidated into silence by the slave power. And when you look at the record, you actually see again and again Republicans rising to their feet and insisting in one way or another, I'm a new kind of Northerner. I was sent here to fight for my rights, to fight for the rights of the North, and to fight for my state. I was brought here to fight. So basically, bring it on. There's one Ohio senator, I think, comes to the Senate for the first time and puts a gun down on his desk. It's like, okay, I'm a fighting man. You know, that's Northern fighting men is a new phenomenon. So you can see why the late 1850s were the most violent years in congressional history. And this violence wasn't happening in some kind of Washington bubble. Congressmen were acting at the urging of their constituents. And I found one particularly dramatic example of this link between the violence and congressmen and the public in an 1856 newspaper. And you know, when you're researching on databases and looking at newspapers, you ask for something and you get something, but what you don't see is the whole page and the importance or unimportance of the particular thing you're looking at. In this case, what I'm about to read to you was like a little square on the bottom right corner. It was clearly unimportant. And it was a little item, and it said that a Massachusetts congressman headed back to Washington had been met at the train station by a group of his constituents, and they had given him a gift to take back to Congress. It was a gun, inscribed with the words, free speech. That's really clear. These people wanted their congressmen to fight for their rights, and fight congressmen did. And people at the time understood the implications. And I want to offer you an example of one particular fight with a fighting Northerner and a Southerner that took place in 1858. It was dramatic, and people at the time started to think about the implications. It happened during an overnight session. Overnight sessions were always bad because congressmen would go out to dinner and would drink, and then they would come back boozed up and debate tense issues, and a fight would break out almost inevitably. So that when I was doing my research and reading the record and I would get to an evening session, I would be like, okay. There's one night, I think, where three different fights broke out in the House. So this is after dinner in the House. Republican Galusha Groh, which is a wonderful 19th century name, Galusha Groh of Pennsylvania, was standing amidst some Southerners in the House when he objected to something being said on the floor. Lawrence Kitt of South Carolina, supposedly a bit tipsy, yelled out that Groh should object from his own part of the House, not while standing near Southerners. Groh responded that it was a free House and he wouldn't take orders from a whip-holding slave driver. That's fighting man talk. So at this, Kitt supposedly muttered, "We'll see about that," and strutted over to Groh and reached out to grab his collar so he could punch him. But Groh beat Kitt to it and punched him and knocked him flat. He fell to the ground. At this, a stream of Southerners began racing across the chamber to the point of conflict, some probably to break it up, some probably to join in. Seeing that happen, Republicans began streaming across the House, jumping on desks and chairs in their haste to get down to help a fellow Republican in trouble. And the end result was a mass brawl in front of the Speaker's platform, with scores of armed Northerners and Southerners running at each other and fighting in the space in front of that platform. The fighting ended only when one congressman grabbed another congressman's hair to slug him in the face, and his hair came off because he was wearing a toupee. And what I love about that is that slapstick is eternal, right? That joke never stops being funny. So they began to laugh, and people sat down, and it calmed down. In the end, there wasn't a lot of damage done aside from some black eyes and torn clothing, but the significance of that event was clear, and reporters at the time said, that looked like a battle. Armed men running at each other, north and south, that looked like a battle. And in some ways, it was. Now, looking back with the advantage of time, we obviously can see where this is leading. Of course, people at the time didn't necessarily assume as much. They didn't know what was coming. And some people focused on the ridiculousness of the situation, the degree to which this kind of behavior seemed so extreme. An entire genre of congressional humor broke out in the 1850s. There was sort of mock epic poetry and cartoons. There's actually a humor magazine that comes about right around the time. Well, I think right around the time that fight happens, as a matter of fact. It was titled Vanity Fair, which does not lead to our Vanity Fair today, but as far as in my research, I sort of nicknamed it Congressional Fight Quarterly because so much of it, this little humor magazine, was just making fun of congressmen. Their launching issue was a picture or drawing of two congressmen throwing things at each other, including small animals. So some people were laughing. Not everyone was laughing. A good many people became increasingly angry at people from the opposing part of the union and increasingly concerned about the union itself. Anger, outrage, concern, laughter, intimidation, in many ways, the road to civil warfare as reflected in Congress was a trajectory of emotion concerning the sectional other in Congress and in the union. And in fact, part of what I wanted to accomplish with this book was to look at a conventional story, right, the coming of the Civil War, but to use a less conventional lens. I basically wanted to understand how people and then a nation grew to distrust and hate each other to the point that they were willing to fight and even kill. But that's nice for me to say as a historian. How do you show and analyze changing emotions? So this was one of the biggest challenges that I had in front of me as I was writing on this topic, confronting this topic in my book. And in the end, to solve that problem, I put a guide of sorts at its center. Not quite a narrator, but a person who the reader could travel with through the book and you would sort of look through this person's eyes and see changing events and see his feelings shift over time. And he would help you experience what it felt like and how things changed. And to accomplish this, I used the diary of a man named Benjamin Brown French. He was a minor clerk in the House of Representatives. He moved in congressional circles for decades. He came to Washington in the 1830s. He died in 1870, so he's there exactly when I want him to be there. And he kept a remarkable 11-volume diary that is filled with reflections and thoughts and observations and feelings about Congress in neat handwriting because he was a clerk. And it also obviously detailed fights. So he gave me a lot of visual evidence. I could see what was happening. But more than that, his transition over the years covered in this book really taught me something. So he comes to Washington in 1833 as what would have been called a dough-faced Democrat, a Northern Democrat who basically is willing to do anything to appease the South and promote his party and hopefully to save the Union. French was well-liked by Northerners and Southerners, by Whigs and Democrats. Maybe the best proof of that is that when he became clerk, which he was, I think, for one term, he was unanimously elected clerk from everybody on all sides. So very popular guy, dough-faced. All he wants is to appease Southerners so that everything will stay okay. In 1860, he went out to buy a gun in case he needed to shoot some Southerners. He talks about it in his diary. And by that point, he's calling Southerners slavocrats. That's a remarkable transition. And he wasn't the only one making it. And so my thought in writing the book was that if readers meet French at the beginning, when he's desperately trying to appease Southerners, and understand in some way how by the book's end, he's willing to shoot them. So if you basically are following his trail of emotion and understanding, and you can see it bit by bit, you can see him become distrustful and then angry and then more angry and then, you know, frightened and angry. You can see his transition. If people could follow a person through that, well, then maybe I had added some kind of new thread of understanding on this very familiar story, you know, the road to the Civil War, the coming of the war. French enabled me to explore what I called the emotional logic of disunion. Not the political logic, not the sectional logic, but the emotional logic of how it came to feel that it was the right thing at that moment for people. Now, of course, that emotional logic of disunion was visible both inside and outside of Congress. In Congress, by 1860, most congressmen were armed, and many expected armed conflict to break out on either the floor of the House or Senate. It's remarkable the amount of times that fear is mentioned. An example of that, South Carolina Senator James Henry Hammond wrote a remarkable letter in 1860. What's fascinating about this letter to me is people often quote this one sentence from it, and the one sentence says, everyone has a gun here, and those who seemingly don't have a gun here have two guns here or something. It's a sentence, a kind of goofy sentence, and if you look at Coming of the Civil War books, you will see him quoted. Of course, what's really interesting about the letter is what comes after that. He says, I have a gun. It's in my desk and it's loaded. And he explains how he doesn't like carrying a gun and he carried one once and he didn't like it, so he put it away. But now he has a gun in his desk because he thought that Republicans could precipitate at any moment a collision in which the slaughter would be such as to shock the world and dissolve the government. So he basically says he has that gun in his desk because if armed warfare broke out in the House, he wanted to be armed and ready to fight with the South. That's a remarkable statement. Benjamin Brown French bought a gun in 1860 for the same reason. He didn't want to shoot Southerners, but he was afraid that he might have to. By 1860, he and many others had reasoned their way into seeing the sectional opposition as an un-American other, sacrificing national interests to their own selfish sectional desires. Now, this is a powerful story, obviously. It's a story about extreme polarization, about conflicting visions of what kind of nation the United States would be, about splintering political parties. about new technologies complicating the conversation of politics, about rampant distrust in national political institutions. Obviously, there are echoes of this past in our present. And I have to say that when I started out by saying this was an odd time to come out with this book, this was an odd time to come out with this book. There were times at which I had to walk away from my desk because what I was seeing on TV and what I was writing about felt too similar. But despite those similarities, I think it's important for me to say I'm not making some kind of implicit statement about modern day politics by describing the story that I've just told you. What is worth noting is that the United States has had moments in its past that resemble in tone or feeling our present. Not identical, history actually doesn't repeat, but they bear some similarities. And those moments tend to be moments when, not surprisingly, Americans feel that some kind of major pathway is going to be chosen, some kind of discussion is underway that really matters, some kind of major decision about the nation's future. And those tend to be, not surprisingly, ugly polarizing moments. The 1790s was one such moment, when people were really, the late 1790s, very violent, crazy language, people waiting in case they might have to take over Congress if the vote wasn't an actual real election. They were talking about democracy and how democratic this new government should be. The 1850s, they're talking about slavery. The 1960s, another one of these violent, polarizing moments, civil rights were under debate. And I think in some ways now what we're debating is citizenship. And that's pretty major. So as a historian taking a long, long view back, there are reasons why this moment is happening, and there have been other moments that at least have echoed this, not repeated it in any way. All of these moments, there's something in the air that suggests there might be big change, and that's logically enough a polarizing moment. What saves us during these kinds of moments is our political process. The founding generation believed that one of the most significant things that they did for the future of the nation was creating a defined, documented constitutional process and setting it in motion. And I will say that I did not write this last page today, or this year, even. Whatever resonance you're hearing, I probably wrote this at this paragraph because I couldn't figure out what I wanted to end this with, maybe 2 years ago. So the founding generation thought that one of the most significant things that they did for the future was creating this defined document that had a process of governance in it and setting it in motion. It's why James Madison took such careful notes during the Constitutional Convention, documenting precisely how the Constitution was made, not only for the American nation, but for other nations that might want to create a constitution of their own. We can argue about how we interpret the process in the Constitution, and indeed we always do and probably always will, but it was the existence of that grounding process as an anchor that mattered. As Hamilton wrote in the first paragraph of the first Federalist essay, and I read this in almost every class I teach at Yale. Actually, I'm not going to read the whole quote, but I'm going to give you the sentiment. He says that most nations are founded on accident and force. The American nation was founded on reasoned debate and compromise. We were trying something different. That wasn't typically how nations get founded. Reflection and choice. And they assumed that during moments of crisis to come, that process, that reflection and choice, would be part of what would set the nation on the right course again. He says something in his quote like, it will be a tragedy for all of mankind if we do not recognize the significance of what we're doing here in founding a different kind of government. So he and his generation assumed that during crises to come, this constitutional process set in motion through reflection and choice, grounded on debate and compromise, would be the key to national survival. And I will stop there and say thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer questions. Thank you. Thank you.
Is it on? Yeah.
Here we go. I saw you first. Introduce yourself.
Tony Langham. Was Preston Brooks, did he suffer any penalties for almost killing a guy?
Quite the opposite. Kind of along the lines of what I said, right, that fighting men often get rewarded. The question, if for those who didn't hear, is did Preston Brooks, who caned Sumner, suffer any penalty? No, he became a hero in the South. He was sent canes, honorary canes as gifts. He was sent one cane, and inscribed on the head of it was, "Hit him again." So, no, he didn't suffer. He actually died of a throat infection. He was reelected to Congress, as fighting men were, and he got some kind of a throat infection and died. And Northerners all thought this was providential. You know, okay, well, he's gone. He deserved to go. But no, he didn't really suffer. And he stood up. If you do go look at the record, you'll see he stands up and gives a very dramatic speech about why he did what he did and why he deserved to do what he did and why Sumner basically deserved what he got. He's not sorry for what he did. He leaves and goes home, but he's not apologetic. He felt that he was defending the South and defending South Carolina and defending his family. So that, in and of itself, that's telling.
Can you give us an idea of the numbers of incidents and overtime, 1820s, 1830s, 1840s, 1850s? Was there a spillover outside of Congress into the rooming houses where they lived?
Okay, good. What, was there spillover from what was happening in Congress to rooming houses? There was some. And what was interesting about that, not a lot. So most of what I was talking about was actually in either in the House and Senate chambers or in the Capitol building. There were a couple incidents on the street. There were a couple incidents at Willard's Hotel, the Willard Hotel, which for some reason is like Congressional Fight Center. I don't know why that hotel, more than all the other hotels, attracted fights, but it did. Actually, Preston Brooks got into a fight after the caning in Willard's Hotel. But there were a couple incidents that broke out in boarding houses. Now, in boarding houses, the people living there tend to get along with each other, right? Sometimes they're from the same part of the country. Sometimes they're from the same party. So it would have to be, and this is how typically it happened, over a dinner conversation, that someone would say something and then matters would go too far, and they would really have to go too far because there were women there too, right? So congressmen didn't want to do this in front of women. As a matter of fact, sometimes on the floor, when it was obvious things were going to get violent, congressmen would glance up at the galleries to see how many women were present. Preston Brooks walks into the Senate with his cane ready to cane Sumner. There's a woman in the room, and he sits down and waits for her to leave before he canes Sumner. As a matter of fact, a friend comes over and he sees him like staring at this woman, and he says, "Yes, she is rather attractive, isn't she?" Brooks says, "Yes, and I wish she would leave." So he waited for her to leave before the caning. But so boarding houses saw some violence, but it tended to be of the moment and born, actually, I think more than anything else, of dinner conversation. And sometimes those kinds of things could be settled because there was so much in a small boarding house with people living together so intimately. There were so many bonds that those don't normally end up in duels.
Numbers.
I'm not going to have no offhand. I mean, I know I can think offhand of at least three in the 1850s, in the late 1850s, but I would have to look to find more. Definitely a small number.
So are the laws that govern the rest of us suspended for members of Congress? I mean, if I come in here and I cane you, I'm arrested.
Yeah.
If I lie about him, I'm arrested. I mean, how does that happen, that we allow our solons to get away with this crap? I'm sorry.
And well, the last part of your statement is part of the answer, right? Is that these, and actually this is longstanding, it's not just this period, these men were, you know, the elite, the ruling elite who made the laws, and in one degree or another, felt that they were above the law. There's an example in the book. There's a congressman who's picking flowers on the Capitol grounds to give to his girlfriend. and a Capitol Police officer comes over and says, sir, that's against the rules. You're not allowed to pick the flowers here. And this guy says, I'm a congressman and I can do whatever I want, and starts like wildly picking flowers because he can. Preston Brooks is brought to court. So it isn't as though people entirely avoid the legal system. He's brought to court, and along with him come a stream of congressmen who stand there alongside him in Congress. And I think he's like fined $500, the end. So, you know, the same thing with the, if you go all the way back in time to the Burr-Hamilton duel. After the Burr-Hamilton duel, a bunch of Republicans, Jeffersonian Republicans, made a petition because Burr was being brought up on charges in New York and New Jersey. These Republicans made up a petition, and what it basically said is, this isn't fair. We never charge people for doing stuff like this. Why is Burr in trouble? So that shows you the ways in which sort of, you know, social rank mattered in this period. But these men were men who could assume that they certainly had a lot of privilege and advantage that would enable them to slide out of most situations.
I was curious as to whether you compared to other cultures in your book. So, for instance, I always understood that in the British Parliament, there were two sword lengths separated the benches of the opposition and the government parties. Did you look at that, and did you address that at all in your book?
I don't talk about it in the book. I did go to the British Library and do some research, partly because I thought, you know, that's the heritage of whatever is going on here, so I want to see what that's like. Partly because Congress and Parliament talk about each other during this period. And what I found was there's a lot of foot stamping and hat throwing and some insults and some dueling outside. But as a British friend of mine put it, there was no blood on the carpet in the Houses of Parliament. So there are these interesting comments from, I found actually there was a British diplomat who, as he was parting, was giving advice to the person coming in. And in the letter, he says, okay, here's the thing. You don't want to go down on the floor of the house because it's dangerous down there. Stay up here in the galleries and talk to them outside, right? They're crazy here. Meanwhile, the Americans are looking at the British and are shocked and horrified that in Parliament, they make all kinds of noises to drown each other out. And it, somehow in Congress, that was a big problem, right? The violence felt to them, every once in a while you have a fight. But that sort of disrespect in Congress, they once in a while people will say, well, you know, it's not so bad here. I mean, look at Parliament. They're uncivilized over there in Parliament. So there wasn't the kind of violence that was going on in Congress happening in Parliament.
Hi, I'm Michael Altman. Thank you for coming here. Firstly, to the gentleman's question over there, weren't the congressmen precluded from any legal jeopardy in the dispensation of their duties as congressmen, so they were actually legally protected?
Well, for what they said on the floor and in coming to and going to Washington, but yeah, they were legally, so and this is interesting, so legally speaking, they were protected from anything they said on the floor, that they which is obviously an encouragement for people to speak freely. What congressmen did when they got in a fight of some kind, particularly if it's an insult-bound fight, they would stand up and say, I throw away my privileges. So basically, I'm just standing here in front of you, not taking advantage of that. So it was cowardly to grab at that. And I think that was just sort of funneled into this weird combination of things that led people to make these kinds of decisions.
So my question for you, aside from that, is over the 30 years or 40 years that you looked at the legislative agenda, how much of legislation do you think was actually affected by the scare tactics that each one of the congressmen and senators, you know, did upon each other? Was it only the third rail of slavery, or was it a lot of other agendas that didn't get put forth because people were too scared to vote their conscience?
Well, I think the latter is more true. I mean, I do think slavery was the third rail. And in one way or another, if conversation got heated on slavery, you knew something bad was going to happen. But the early fighting in the 1830s and early 1840s was largely party bound. It was less about slavery and more about one party versus another. Henry Wise starts a fight by walking into a room with a newspaper and saying, this newspaper says some Democrat here is corrupt. I don't know who he is, but I know you are corrupt or something. And Democrats get insulted and there's kind of a fight. And that's just party bell. That has nothing to do with anything. But your larger question, which is how many things, it depended so much on the people and the interlinking between what they were talking about and what else was going on. So, you know, if one party's feeling weak at a particular moment and sees a moment on the floor, whatever the issue, to take advantage of it, like, or when they're talking about basic things like the numbers of people, right? A lot of elections were contested in this period, and there was one case in which there's a committee formed to decide who actually wins the election, and the person from the side that is not written up in the report, so basically the losing person, his member of his party stands up and says, this isn't coming out of the room. And any of you that try, this door is closed. Come by me. That the reason I know that is because then someone is brave enough to say on the floor, you know what just happened in there? But still, that was trying to intimidate just the numbers on the floor. So it kind of is everywhere. And the important thing about it is not the violence. There was a good amount of it. It was the intimidation that it inflicted. It was the fact that you never knew what might happen if you stood up and resisted. And that, in and of itself, did indeed just encourage people to sit. John Quincy Adams has a huge diary, and in his diary, lots of people come to him and say, in one way or another, I was afraid to stand up, or I stood up and someone said this about me. I think someone comes to him crying. There was a mood, a kind of ethos, that knowledge that was there as a threat had over Congress. So in that sense, it influenced a lot of things.
You know, I'm sitting here and listening to you starting to write a book 17 years ago, I believe. And I think it's fair to say that history repeats itself. In many ways, right, from journalism, diplomatic immunity, people saying they will not vote their conscience, etc. Have you thought about that and the similarities between what happened in the 1850s and today?
As a historian, I would say that history does not repeat. And the reason I say that is because times are different, the context is different, the culture is different, so that we can say that there are similar phenomena happening, bundles of things happening at the same time. But how they're going to play out and what happens because of that is going to be shaped by so many different things. So what creates a moment like this in 1850 is going to be very different from whatever's going on now. So I don't think it's repeating. You know, I think sometimes I'm asked to go on cable news shows and they want me to say, like, what do you think is going to happen? It's like, just because I study the past doesn't mean I know it's going to happen now. I don't know. I think we have a long history of putting the other side, creating them, seeing them as an other. At moments of real importance, when something important is at stake. I think we see over and over and over again Americans getting to the point where they think, like Benjamin Brown French, you're not American. What you're thinking about is not American. You're the other. So basically, we can do whatever we need to do to save America, right? That's othering talk, and that makes sense that's going to echo throughout time. But I don't think I would say repeats.
How did this period end? I mean, we have plenty of vitriol today, but it doesn't resort to violence on the congressional floor.
Good question. I think the Civil War has something to do with it. I think, you know, the war is fought and two things happen. One is the nation just spent a lot of time killing itself, so the violence is not going to have the same kind of cachet. But more important than that, the Northerners have power. So, like, there's an incident very early. I think it's when Louisiana is trying to get back into the Union. And a Louisiana congressman feels insulted that they're being made to wait, that, you know, it's disrespectful. And he ends up caning someone in the Capitol. And a congressman stands up, I believe in the Senate, and says, Do we want to let this back in? Do you remember? Some of you are too young to remember. I was there. I remember what it was like in the 1850s with these men with their weapons threatening us. Do we want to let that back in? So Northerners had a different kind of power, and I think that changed the nature of things. Didn't make it civilized and pretty, but Southerners could not as easily do what they had been doing before.
This is going to be the last question.
Okay.
Make it a good one.
Oh, I will. Abraham Lincoln served one term in Congress. In any of his writings, did he report any of this violence that he personally observed?
Not that I found. I had to dig to find this stuff, and I don't think I found anything in his papers. There are some people who happily wrote letters to their wives and don't talk about this at all. There are some people who are struck by it or mention it once in their diary. There's an Ohio congressman who has just one little diary passage in which a congressman was illegally trying to claim money that he didn't deserve from the government. And this guy writes in his diary, he's a Southerner. He says, no one from the North is going to stand up and oppose him because he's a Southerner and they're afraid they're going to have to fight a duel, so he's getting away with it. That's like a tiny random three sentences in some diary. But you have that a couple of times, and you can see, related to your question, that it isn't advertising itself, and it's everybody doesn't talk about it, but there sure is a powerful influence.
So tomorrow evening on Brian Williams' show on MSNBC at 11 o'clock at night, Joanne, I'm sure, is going to be asked, what's going to happen now? Because you have this insight.
And I will say, I don't know.
So stay up and watch or put it on DVR.
Between 11
or whatever,
and 12.
Between
yeah.
11 and 12.
I have no idea.
So anyway, I'm sorry we couldn't get to all the questions. Joanne will be signing books where? Out there? Back here. Okay. And thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.